Parshav Noso contains a number of quite different looking items. In fact, there's a discussion in itself how all of these form some form of sequence. There's Nazir, and there's Sota, and there's Duchening, and there's the Nasiyim. And I'd like to begin and maybe try and have a few words on some of these. And take a look for the opening segment of the Shir at the section of Nazir, which is in Perek Vav. And as we know, the Nazir is forbidden for certain things. It's forbidden to eat certain things and drink, aside from other prohibitions, Tumas Meis and cutting his hair. Pasuk Gimel tells us what it is that he can't eat and that he can't drink. Miyayin v'sheichar yazir. Sheichar here actually refers to another type of wine. Newer wine, older wine. Chometz yayin, not only can he not drink wine, he can't also drink vinegar that's made from wine. V'chometz sheichar lo yishteh. V'chol mishras hanovim lo yishteh. Anything that's soaked or dipped in grape juice. V'hanovim lachem v'yaveshim, he can't eat grapes. So it's a full-on avoidance and prohibition of anything that relates to grapes, anything that relates to wine. The Medrash, very interestingly, comments that here you see the concept of a siyag min haTorah. Siyag is a protective fence. We know about siyag from the beginning of Pirkei Avos. One of the first things we're told by the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, Aseh Lecha Rav, etc., Asu siyag la Torah, make a protective fence to get around the Torah. It's important enough to protect against. And in our experience, the concept of siyag, of a protective measure, tends to fall in the domain of the Rabbanan. That is to say, the Torah assers the thing itself, and the Rabbanan asser one step away from that as a protective measure. And yet here we see that actually, in this instance, the Torah itself set up a protective measure against the prohibition, in the sense of broadening it to anything that relates to wine. The essential problem is wine. But the Torah says, in the words of the Medrash, don't even go there. Don't have any grapes, no grape juice, no vinegar. The whole thing is off limits. And it's an amazing example of a concept where the Torah itself made a siyag for one of its prohibitions. And this relates to the general idea that ultimately everything that the Rabbanon do is based in something that's in the Torah. The Rabbanon have widespread siyagim, but the concept of a protective measure is in the Torah itself. Perhaps, interestingly, as a colleague of mine pointed out, if you look closely at Pasuk Gimel, we may see a basis for this characterization of the, shall we say, the Isser itself, and then the Torah-mandated protective measures. For when it comes to the wine, the Torah uses a different verb than it does for those other things. Miyayin v'sheichar, yazir. Yazir means he needs to remove himself in the sense of not consuming. But then goes on to say, Chometz Yayin v'chometz Sheichar lo yishteh. It moves from Yazir, which is more characteristic of the Nazir, to lo yishteh, don't drink. V'chom Mishras Hanavim lo yishteh, any something that's been soaked in it, lo yishteh. V'anavim lachem v'yaveshim, grapes lo yocheil. So you see that of the half a dozen things really that are mentioned in the Pasuk, it's the first two that the Nazir verb is used as a way of saying not to consume them. And everything else goes to don't drink and don't eat. They are the siyagim. In fact, this may help us explain a very interesting halachic curiosity. And that is, as we know, there are critical amounts both for eating and for drinking, although even a minute amount is also on a Torah level, but when it comes to the incurring liabilities, etc., there is the shiur, there's the critical amount, the minimum amount. What is the shiur? Well, for eating, as we know, the shiur will always be a kazayas, the volume of an olive. And when it comes to drinking, something that's either a mitzvah to drink or an iser to drink, the crew would be a revius, which is quite a bit more than a kazayas. And so it is, as we know from our own experiences in the mitzvahs, etc. According to one opinion, the critical shear for a nazir, when he's told not only that he shouldn't drink wine or grape juice, but also he can't eat grapes, the shear that would incur liability if he were to eat grapes is the solid equivalent of a revius. That is to say, not a kazayas, but actually a solid revius, however much that is, 86 mil. And it's most unusual. The explanation, perhaps, is based on this understanding that all of those other foods or grape products are a siag. They are a protective measure that one shouldn't come to actually drink the wine itself. If that's the case, if they're there to protect against the wine, then their status wouldn't be more stringent than the wine itself. As surely as the wine being a liquid, the critical amount, the shear would be a revius. Anything that's there to protect against it, even if it's a solid, will not then have the smaller critical amount of a kazayas. It will remain a solid revius. Okay, so there we are in Maseches Nazir Daf Lamed Ches. All of these are emanations of this very interesting example of siag min haTorah. The Torah protected against its own isurim. Of course, once it does, those protections themselves are an isur Torah. Another thing that's asur for the nazir is to come into contact with the mace, with a deceased, and that's in Pasuk Vav and Pasuk Zayin, and actually the Torah is quite stringent with him. Kol yumei hasiro l'Hashem, says Pasuk Vav, al nefesh mace lo yavo, he cannot, is forbidden to come into contact with any mace. As we mentioned in the past, his nazirus and his introspection and his soul-searching and whatever nazirus is shouldn't take him away from life. On the contrary, he's looking to develop his life in the future, and therefore it needs to be emphasized by avoiding anything to do with death. La'aviv u'le'imo, his father, mother, la'achav la'achoso, brother, sister, all none of them, lo yitam lehem b'mosam, which actually makes the nazir more equivalent to a Kohen Gadol than actually a Kohen. Even a Kohen in general, he can't come into contact with a mace. But there are exceptions of close family members. For a Kohen Gadol, there's no exceptions. And similarly here for a Nazir, whether father or mother, it doesn't matter. Interesting, if we're holding up the Nazir and comparing him with the Kohen Gadol, there are actually some family members that are not mentioned in the pasuk, even though the halacha is true for them. When it comes to the Kohen Gadol, a few weeks ago in Parshas Emor, all seven close family members are mentioned as he can't come to contact with any of them. Not father, mother, brother, sister, wife, son, and daughter. Those final three, they're true for a Nazir also, but somehow they're not mentioned in the pasuk. There's only a list of four. And that's an interesting shaila. If his status is the same as the Kohen Gadol, and it is with regards to all seven, how come three of them aren't mentioned in the pasuk? Interesting. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a very novel explanation, suggestion as to why this would be. Who can become a nazir? Well, anyone. If a person feels that they need to or they want to, whatever a nazirus does, they can. That's true. But yet, as true as it is that anyone can be a Nazir, and for some people it's maybe even a good idea, it seems, says Rabbi Yaakov, that the recommendation of the Torah is more that this is for someone who's not married, as opposed to yes, married. Why would we say this? For two reasons. Firstly, the temptations that lead to Nazirus, as we know, it follows on from the case of Sota. He's seen what all sorts of mischief can occur, and therefore he takes a bit of time out in order to make sure that he's on the straight and narrow. Those are temptations that would more be affecting someone who's not married, naturally. So the need would be more for someone not yet married. Secondly, being a nazir can sometimes interfere. It's Kiddush time, and he's not making Kiddush, because, or he makes Kiddush on challah, or who knows what. And all of these things, his hair is growing long, if he's not married. So if he grows his hair long, he'll probably stay not married just for a little bit longer, which is fine anyway. But for someone to lead a normal family life, these things are not disasters, but nonetheless they're disruptive to a certain degree. And therefore, in terms of why one would want to be a nazir, and in terms of what is involved in being a nazir, it seems that it's really more for the unmarried than the married. And the truth is, says Rabbi Yaakov, and this of course is one of his fortes, is that the whole of Tanakh for Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was one. And therefore, for some of us, once we get past Chamishichum Shei Torah, we're in the dark. But for Rabbi Yaakov, it's all illuminated. The Pasuk says in Amos, Perek Beis, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu talks about the Jewish people and how what he did for them, Va'etein mi bneichem lenevi'im, I took from amongst your sons and I gave them as prophets. Umi bachureichem lenezirim. Mi bachureichem, from your bachrim, from your unmarried sons, lenezirim. On the one hand, the Pasuk is emphasizing that the domain of Naziris is for Bachurim. Exactly what we're saying. Not that it's restricted to them, but it naturally accrues to them. And if that's so, says Rabbi Yaakov, perhaps we can see what is often the case, that what is explicit in the Navi is implicit in the Chumash. The Navi says, who should be a Nazir? Bachurim. Can someone else if they want to? Yes, but who's it recommended for? For Bachurim. So come back to the list of people that the Torah says the Nazir can't be Tomei for. There's four. Le'aviv u'le'imo, le'achiv v'lachoso. Father, mother, brother, sister. So we ask the Shaila, but can he become married, can become Tomei for la'aleinu, for his wife? For a child, for a son, for a daughter, also not, like a Kohen Gadol. So why are those three not on the list? Says Rabbi Yaakov, this seems to be what we're saying. That the Torah is recommending Naziris for a person who's not married. So there's only four on the list of his close family members. It's a wonderful insight into really al derech ha-pshat in the Pasuk. Okay. And what will happen if he comes into contact with the mace? Pasuk Tes reads, V'chia mus mace ala b'petza pitom. It happened. He couldn't defend against it. It was sudden. All of a sudden, someone dies in his vicinity in a way that makes him tame, the same room or whatever. V'timei rosh nizros. So that's the end of his nazirus. He has to start again from the beginning. And there's a whole process for this, and there's interim korbanos that he brings, and he has to shave his head, and it's a whole process, and he starts again. In Pasuk Yud, he brings the korbanos to Torim, and then Pasuk Yud Aleph reads, V'asa ha-kohen, echad l'chatos, v'echad l'ola, one of these birds, sin offering, one's an ola, v'chiper alav, mi'asher chata al hanofesh. And he'll atone for the nazir. The nazir sinned with the soul, asher chata al hanofesh, and then he starts again. The shaila is, the Pasuk says the Nazir sinned on a soul. Whose soul is that? Whose soul did he sin with? Well, let's see. Rashi says, Miasher Chatala Nafesh, Rashi explains, actually gives two Perushim. The first is, Sheloniz Hamitumas Hames. He wasn't careful with regards to Tumas Mace. He's told not to come into contact with the mace, and here he did it. So chotel nefesh. Who's the nefesh? The nefesh is the dead nefesh. Is the dead person, and this person, the nazir, he's the chote. Now Rashi chose this because it seems to be the simplest reading of the pasuk. Chotel nefesh, and in the event that he comes into contact with a mace, that was wrong. Except. It's still difficult to say that, to call him a chote, because the Pasuk itself said that someone died in his vicinity, and the Pasuk introduces it with the words bepeta pitom, means it happened suddenly. It's not that he elected to put himself in the same premises, under the same roof. It happened. So how can he be indicted for something that was force majeure, was against he couldn't control? One can say, well, what can one say? He should have avoided it somehow. How could he know? Difficult to defend against. And then, therefore, Rashi moves to a second perush. Rabbi Elazar HaKapa Omer, Shetzir Atzmo Min Hayayim. Here we begin to see what seems to be a statement about the Nazir himself. He's Chot Al Nefesh. He sinned on a soul. Whose soul has he sinned on? His own. How so? Because by being a Nazir, he's deprived himself from wine. And that's not okay. And indeed, there is a major machlokas in the Gemara and Maseches Tanis and Daf Yud Aleph as to how we look at a Nazir. The truth is that we get both sides of the equation we get from the Pasuk. The one hand, the Pasuk calls him Kadosh, which sounds positive. He's holy. On the other hand, the Pasuk calls him a Chote. So the Gemara works it out. Which is he? Is it good for the Jews? Is it bad for the Jews? Is he good to be a Nazir? Positive or negative? And Rashi here quotes Rabbi Elazar HaKapa, who says that ultimately the Nazir is called a chote. He shouldn't have deprived himself from the pleasures of this world. Now, firstly, depriving himself from wine has got nothing to do, seemingly, with becoming tamei for a mace. In other words, as soon as he's a Nazir, even if he doesn't come into contact with the deceased, he still deprived himself from wine. So why would the Torah use this setting of Tumas Meis to introduce what seems to be a general statement about a Nazir? And again, there is something of a tension between the messages of the Pasuk, because the Pasuk calls him a Kadosh. So is he a Kadosh and a Chote? It doesn't seem to be room for both of them. Well, the Levush, one of the great, the Mefarshei Rashi, the Levush HaOra, explains that actually what Rashi is doing here is taking a bit of a middle path in terms of how to judge a Nazir. Is it positive? Is it negative? Generally speaking, the standard term of Nazirus is 30 days. 30 days is reasonable, savir, as they say. And that's an okay term, and it's worthwhile. And he's a Kaddish. However, what would happen if something would transpire which caused those original days, or some of them, or all of them, to, so to speak, go to waste? In that instance, it would turn out retrospectively that he was stam, not drinking wine, that he didn't have value of being a Nazir. That's what happens. If he comes into contact with a mace during his term of Nazirus, those days, as the Pasuk says, Ayarmim Arishonim Yiplu, they fall away. I mean, they're not counted as his Nazirus. He has to start again. Therefore, in retrospect, he wasn't a Nazir. He was stam, not drinking wine. That's not okay. It's not in the service of Nazirus. And that is exactly why, according to Rashi, the Torah chose the juncture or the contingency of him coming into contact with a mace and then called him a chote. Because it's specifically because he came into contact with a mace and the first days evaporated, leaving him just with not having drunk wine. That's not okay. Whereas the Torah wouldn't have said it had he not come into contact with a mace, because then they would all be bona fide in the Nazirus days. And it's all in the service of being a Nazir, and it works, and it's worthwhile, and then he will be called a Kaddish. Interestingly, just to further this vein, the Netziv and the Hamikdavar states that he can't protect, like, if a person dies in his vicinity, there's nothing he can do about it if it's sudden. But it is a message for him, aside from everything else. It's a message for him that his Nazirus was not yet up to par. Perhaps, I mean, Nazirus is the extra mile. It's an extra act of extra piety. And by the Torah nullifying this term of Nazirus, it's sending a message to him. He was not perhaps up to being a Nazir at that time. He needs to get himself together a little bit more. And in fact, the Netziv says, this is the meaning of the term Ashechata al Hanefesh. He sinned with regards to a soul. What does that mean? There is another place that we find this expression, Chata al Hanefesh, Chata b'nefesh, and that is in a few weeks' time in Parshas Korach, where you have Korach's 250 men, and they are described by the Torah as Hachatoyim ha'ele b'nafshosam. They're sinning with their souls. But what does it mean for someone to sin with his soul? Is all sinning with the soul? The Torah says it specifically about them. The point is, says the Netziv, as part of his general analysis of the whole episode of Parshas Korach, these 250 men, their motivation was very different than that of Korach, and certainly worlds apart from that of Nadav and Avihu. Korach remains a bit of an enigma. Nadav and Avihu, it's quite clear, they're in the machlokas business. The 250 men, they really genuinely felt deprived and hard done by, that they were not able to, they were dismissed and demoted from the avoda, they were bechorim, whatever they were, and they couldn't accept that they were barred from getting as close as possible to the divine, and therefore they were prepared even to take it by force, so to speak. It's a very strange situation whereby they're prepared almost to break the rules in order to achieve the spiritual closeness that they can, even though in principle, if you're breaking the rules, that doesn't sound like a very spiritually healthy thing to do. And that's where they're called chata'im benafshosam. They sinned with their souls, meaning it was for soul reasons, S-O-U-L, that they wanted to do this. It wasn't because they were looking to lead more physical lives or more pleasure-seeking lives. They wanted to lead more spiritual lives, and it led them to break the rules. And indeed, that's why they didn't die the way everyone else died in Adas Korach. Everyone's punishment fit the crime. When it came to Nadav and Avihu, the earth just swallowed them up, which is the ultimate dismissal. They're nothing. They have no meaning or import. When it comes to the 250 men, they were consumed by a holy fire. That's exactly what happened, as the Pasuk says in the Tziv. That's true. I mean, that's a depiction of them. When they were alive, they were consumed by a holy fire. It destroyed them. That's chata ala nefesh, a person who bites off a little bit more than he should be allowed to chew. And then the Tziv says you have a similar thing with this Nazir. He thinks he's ready to be a Nazir. Not everyone should be a Nazir. Not everyone's up to it. There's enough with the Tariag Mitzvahs. He feels that he's idealistic and etc. When he gets such a drastic message and someone destroys his Nazirah, someone drops dead next to him. So aside from everything else, the Torah is saying he's a chote ve'ala nefesh. That means that he's perhaps also bitten off a bit more than he could chew, and maybe he should reconsider or get himself together before he then re-engages in Nazirus. So that's the Netziv's Perush on Ashechata ala Nefesh. There is a fourth Perush, interestingly, and it's quite a Chiddush. It's from Meshech Chachma. The Torah calls the Nazir Kadosh. Okay, Kadosh Yehiyah, that's in Pasuk Ches. And he really has become like a holy person. From a certain point of view, or to a certain degree, as we've mentioned, he's like the Kohen Gadol. He has the same status of a Kohen Gadol. It's also for him to become a Tomei Lemeis, even for a close family members. And moreover, the Torah describes him in a similar way to the Kohen Gadol. It says in Pasuk Zion, Nezer Elokav Al Rosho, the crown of his God is on his head. That refers to his hair. But it's a Madrega. Nezer Elokav Al Rosho. That is almost identical to what the Pasuk says about the Kohen Gadol, Nezer Elokav Al Rosho in Parshas Emor. So he's mamish like a Kohen Gadol. Says the Meshech Chochma, the Torah is given him titles like the Kohen Gadol, it's given him halachas like the Kohen Gadol, and it gives him responsibilities like a Kohen Gadol. What responsibilities does he have in common with Kohen Gadol? As we know, if someone kills unintentionally, Roteach B'Shogeg, what's called, so he goes to the city of refuge, the Ir Mikla, and he stays there until the Kohen Gadol dies. Now, the Mishnah actually in Maseches Makos explains that the Kohen Gadol was actually the subject, potentially, of a lot of prayers coming from the Ir Miklat, because they know that they're there until he dies. So in Elokein Netzor, somewhere after their davening, they would put in a prayer that the Kohen Gadol perhaps should ascend to higher realms sooner rather than later. So much so, the Gemara says that the mother of the Kohen Gadol, she used to do everything she could to make life as pleasurable and as comfortable for the people in the Ir Miklat. They shouldn't daven, her son should die. But then the Gemara says, there has to be a limit here. In other words, what, they could daven for anything? I mean, even if they daven that he should die, it will make a difference. And he's a good person. Their tefillahs will have an effect. Says the Gemara, possibly. Because he's the Kohen Gadol. And he represents the Jewish people. He should himself be on a madrega where he raises Jewish people and to be on a madrega where this sort of thing doesn't happen. It's an amazing, such a fine indictment, really, ultimately, of the Kohen Gadol. You think, what's he got to do with him? He's in the Beis HaMikdash and he's doing the Avodah. This happens 100 miles away. And the Gemara says, yeah, but if he's the Kohen Gadol to the degree that he should be, it wouldn't have happened. Ad kedei kach. He has that achrayas, either to daven or to raise people up, and there would be a foothold. There's a foot in the door for that tefillah. And therefore the mother of the Kohen Gadol is wise to take the edge off of that prayer. Because if they really did daven for it with all of their hearts, there's justification for it. Ad kedei kach. The Gemara says there in Maseches Makos, Eliyahu HaNavi used to appear to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi regularly. On one occasion, in the vicinity of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, someone met a tragic end, and Eliyahu HaNavi did not appear to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi for 3 days. And that was censure. Because what he's saying is, you're Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. If you were as you should be, that would never have happened. You didn't do anything. But you should have been more Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. And then those sorts of things wouldn't happen. Well, says Meshech Chachma, the Nazir is a kind of a self-made Kohen Gadol. And he's taken upon himself new halachas and a new status. And part of what happens now is that, like the Kohen Gadol, he should be a presence of holiness in his vicinity. And things like this shouldn't happen. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, amazingly, if someone dies right next to the Nazir, the Torah holds him accountable. Because if he really was a Nazir the way he should be, who knows, maybe it wouldn't have happened. When the Pasuk says, if he needs kapara, if he was Nazir to the full degree, to the nth degree, who knows, perhaps this could have been avoided. He didn't do anything wrong, but maybe he could have done more right. That's what it means to be a Nazir. He's like the Kohen Gadol, he's like a local Kohen Gadol. And thus the Torah says, "V'chiper alav asher chata ala nafesh." He sinned against someone's soul. Not he sinned through someone's soul, or he sinned about his own soul. He sinned with the poor soul that expired in his vicinity. Maybe he could have been more of a nazir. That's the achrayus of naziris that we less often hear about, accompanying all of the halachas of nazir. Okay. As the Nazir finishes his term, the Pasuk says, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, he comes and brings his korbanos, and it all ends up well. B'zos Torah HaNazir, b'yom melos yemei nizro, when the term is finally up, yavio so al Pesach ol moed. He should bring himself to the entrance of the ol moed and bring his korbanos, which are described in the ensuing psukim. Yavi oso, who brings whom? Yavi oso, he will bring him. Well, Rashi comments, just so there should be no confusion, Yavi Oso means Yavi Es Atzmo. He'll bring himself, meaning basically he'll come to the Beis HaMikdash to bring his korbanos. Except, if at the end of the day, Yavi Oso, he will bring him, refers to him bringing himself, and it's as if the Pasuk says, Yavo, So why didn't the pasuk just say Yavo? Why did it take the more circuitous route of Yavi Oso, which I then need to almost like whittle down to the equivalent of Yavo? What's contained within these words Yavi Oso? It says Meshechachma again. There's so much thought behind really what a Nazir is meant to do. The Nazir is he's seen things, he's worried about things, he has all sorts of pressures and temptations, and he needs time out, pretty much. That becomes his term of Naziris. Someone who's bothered by desires and temptations to the degree that he needs to be a Nazir, essentially is very much guided by them, influenced by them, and to the degree that sometimes it's very difficult to see things properly and objectively. When a person becomes fixated with something, a desire, either a physical desire or a desire for power or anger or whatever it is, they don't really see things as they are. They don't view the world properly. They certainly have no idea of what they look like or sound like. They have no sense of objectivity in terms of themselves. Really, part of the term of Naziris, which allows a person to move away from the control of his desires, is that it should restore some objectivity of vision. That's the end goal. So that he's able to re-enter life with clear vision. Clear vision about the world around him, and what is can be quite elusive sometimes, clear vision about himself. Which is a rare thing. That's a successful Naziris. And therefore, says Meshechachma, that's why the Torah introduces almost like him at the end of his term of Naziris with the words Yavi Oso, he will bring him. It almost sounds like he's bringing someone else, even though it's himself. That's the goal of Naziris, that he should have as much, after all, we all understand everybody else very clearly, we're bastions of insight when it comes to other people, it's just the very same thing with ourselves, we're completely clueless. And therefore, Yavi Oso means he should be able to move himself with as much objectivity and clarity as he could someone else. That's a successful Naziris. That's why the Torah chose this roundabout way. He can relate to himself almost in the third person because he sees himself for what he is. That's a good Naziris. And then he brings his korbanos, and these are the final words of the Torah on the matter. And the end of Pasuk Kafi, there's many korbanos, special korbanos and special halachas about them. And then at the end of Pasuk Kafi, it says, Va'achar yishte ha-nazir yayin. And then he's all clear. He's not a nazir anymore. He can drink wine again. And the Alshech HaKadosh asks the question, well, if he can only drink wine because he's not a nazir anymore, but still the pasuk calls him a nazir. It says, Achar yishteh ha-nazir yayin. But isn't the point that he's now an ex-nazir? He's not a nazir anymore. That's why he can drink wine. If he's still a nazir, he can't drink wine. So how do you have this blend? But the Alshech explains that, again, as one moves out of Naziris, back to life, back to the world, what's the goal? It's such an unusual state to be in, the state of Naziris. As true as it is that he's looking to break from certain things in the past, but he can't be completely disconnected from the time before and after Naziris. Otherwise, what did it help him? This month or term of Naziris is an investment in effective Jewish living when he's no longer a Nazir. From a certain point of view, the success of his term of Naziris can be told when he's not a Nazir anymore. How does he drink wine? The way that he was afraid to do originally, or the way that he's able to do with measure and with control and with balance? And therefore, as true as it is that he's no longer a halachic Nazir, but the message of Nazir, he should stay with him. V'achar yishteh ha-Nazir yayin. He should be able to perfect the art of he's now a non-practicing Nazir. He is drinking wine with all of the perspective that he gained when he was a Nazir. Because the end goal, as Rashi told us, shetzir atzmo min hayayin, wine and the physical world, it's not the enemy. It's not your friend, but it's not the enemy. It's a challenge, and the person needs to to develop a certain perspective and a certain approach to make a success of things. But the goal is not that he'll never drink wine again. It's that he'll, yes, drink wine with a perspective of nausea. Okay, so these are some thoughts with regards to the Parsha of Naziris. And from there, let's move on to other matters. At the end of Perek Vav, we have Birchas Kohanim, which we are, Baruch Hashem, accustomed to hearing regularly. And the final psukim of Perek Vav, Yivarechecha, Ya'ir, and Yisa. And there's a famous discussion in the Gemara that revolves around the final pasuk of Birchas Kohanim, which is Kaf Vav. Yisa Hashem panav eilecha v'yaseim lecha shalom. Okay, the words, of course, we know. Yisa Hashem panav eilecha, Hashem should favor you. And there's a fascinating discussion which is presented in the Gemara in the third perek of Maseches Brachos in Daf Kaf Amud Beis. And the question is presented by no less than the Malachi Hashoreis. Well, once in a while we have a question that's posed by Malachi Hashoreis. This is the drasha of Rav Avira. Shalom Malachi Hashoreis, they asked a kasha. I guess they're also entitled to ask kashas. So what's the problem? A contradiction. On the one hand it says, Yisa Hashem panav eilecha. Hashem should favor you. How can you say that Hashem should favor you? Does the pasuk not say later on in Parshas Ekev and Dvarim Perek Yud, Hakel Agadol Akibor Banara, Asher lo yisaponim? Hashem will not favor. Asher lo yisaponim, lo yikaf shochat. So if Hashem is described as Asher lo yisaponim, so how can you then say Yisa Hashem panav eilecha? That's the kasha. Okay. Now, it's very interesting to note, and this for me was news. Tosfos, not in Brachos there, but in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yud Zayin, where the question is also raised, have a very interesting comment. Tosfos says, if you read the pasuk carefully, in reality, there's no contradiction. There is no contradiction. Well, why not? It sounds like a contradiction. Yisa versus lo Yisa sounds like a contradiction. Why is there no contradiction? Says Tosfos, watch very carefully. You see, Yisa panim. Whose panim? Whose favor? Whose face? The pasuk in Devarim says, Asher lo Yisa panim, Hashem will not favor people. That means he will not be nose panim of the person. As the judge is always told, lo yisaponim, al tisa pnei dar. I mean, don't favor a person because of their status, either because they're so rich or they're so poor or they're so anything else. That's where it says lo yisaponim. He won't favor a person on account of their status or situation. Our pasuk yisa Hashem panav is that it's panav of Hashem. It's a different type of favoring. It's about looking at you benignly. It's not because of anything that you are. It's not special consideration due to status. So in brief, says Tosus, if you look closely enough at the psukim, you'll see they're actually not really talking on the same wavelength. The Birchas Kohanim, Yisa Hashem Panav, Panav of Hashem, Yisa Eilecha. The Pesukim Devarim says, Lo Yisa Panim, Hashem won't be noticed, the Panim of the person. That remains true, but he could still favor you for other reasons, for his love for the Jewish people, or whatever it could be. That's very interesting. What exactly does Tosfos mean to do by this? This is a departure from Tosfos' job description, really. Throughout the Shas, Tosfos' job is to explain what the Gemara is saying. Here, Tosfos seems to be completely deconstructing what the Gemara is saying. The Gemara, and the Malachi Asharis, no less. The Gemara says there's a contradiction. And Tosfos, instead of explaining further nuances in the contradiction, Tosfos kind of take you to the side and say, well, it's not really a contradiction. Well, somebody thought it was. So what exactly are Tosfos doing here? And yet clearly, what Tosfos are saying is that there's room to ask this question. There's just no room for it, al derech ha-pshat. But there's plenty of room, al derech ha-drash. As if to say, the Gemara has asked the question. The Gemara deals on many wavelengths. And here, the Gemara says, there's a contradiction here. Now, Tosfos says, if you if you look carefully al derech hapshat at the psukim, there doesn't have to be a contradiction. That's true, and it's important to know, and it's got nothing to do with what the Gemara is saying. Because al derech hapshat, okay, one can reconcile the psukim, there's no contradiction. But nonetheless, the drash maintains there is a contradiction, and it should be addressed al derech hadrash. What's fascinating here is that we see something which is a bit rare. We normally understand that the difference between pshat and drash is pshat is, shall we say, the straightforward reading of the pasuk, and drash is the more exacting reading. It's doresh. It demands more. Oftentimes, the drash begins when the pshat left off. And the pshat has been resolved, and the drash says, well, it's not fully resolved, but those are drash issues. It's more yekish than the pshat. Here, we seem to have exactly the opposite. It's the drash seems to have been looking at the pasuk not as closely as the pshat. Tosus gave us the pshat. If you look very carefully, you'll see that there's no contradiction. And the drash apparently didn't look that carefully at the, or chose not to look that carefully at the pasuk. Yisa doesn't look good. That's less exacting than the pshat. But I think really what's happening is, the drash, it's being more exact and just from a different angle. In other words, the drash demands not only that everything in the pasuk works out, but it shouldn't look like it doesn't work out. In other words, personally, when I saw the Tosus who says that there's no contradiction of derech hapshat, I had to read it about 3 times. Until you get the subject and the object, and by the time you're finished, okay, hopefully you'll remember the first thing and then remember the second thing, and there's no real contradiction. But it certainly looks like, it sounds like a contradiction. I don't think most people independently arrived at what Tosfos said. And that's really what the drash is saying. Drash means you demand that everything in the pasuk work out, it shouldn't not work out, and it shouldn't even sound like it doesn't work out. Why have two psukim that are so similar to each other, and they're not exactly the same, but they look like a contradiction? There has to be an explanation. I think there's something very similar happening in a parallel discussion in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, Vayetze, when Yaakov leaves and he gets to the Mokom, Vayivka b'Mokom, it says, Vayikach mi'avnei ha'mokom, Vayosem ra'ashosav, he took some of the stones, and he put them by his head, and then, when he wakes up the next morning, it says, he took the stone, Vayikach es ha'even, so the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Tzadik Aleph, says that's a contradiction, because it began with Loshon Rabim, with there's a lot of stones. And then in the morning there's only one. How could it be? And then we have the whole Masora of they're all combined into one. Each one wanted the tzaddik to have his head resting on him. The well-known Gemara. Tosfos there say exactly the same thing. Tosfos say, you know, al derech hapshat, there isn't really any conflict between these two psukim. Because the first pasuk says, Vayikach me'avnei ha'makom. He took from the stones. How many from the stones of the place? Doesn't say. Could be one. Could be more. But if it could be one, then when the apostle goes on to say, Vayikach es ha'even, now you know. Now you know that he only took one. So now, that means he took even achas me'avnei ha'mokom. So there's actually no contradiction. It could have been one all along. Tosus has done it again. It's the same thing. The Gemara seems to perceive a contradiction. And Tosus say, well, there doesn't have to be a contradiction. But Tosus isn't coming to undermine what the Gemara is saying. Rather, Tosus is saying, on a pshat level, there's no contradiction. But doesn't it look like there's a contradiction? Doesn't me'avni sound like there's more than one? Doesn't have to be, but it sounds like it is. And that's already enough as far as the Gemara is concerned. Why did you make it sound like it if there's more than one, if there's only one? Apparently there are more than one. And that's a very interesting demand of drash. Don't make it sound difficult that you'd need to look at it a second and a third time in order to see why it's not really in conflict. So be that as it may, this is the famous question of the Malachi Asharis. How can you favor the Jewish people? I thought you don't favor people. And Hashem's response is there in the Gemara. How can I not favor them? I wrote in the Torah, Alta v'Savato v'Erachta, which means that there's a mitzvah of birchas hamazon, of benching, only for someone who's fully satiated. Al But they're exacting with themselves. Even after a kazayas or a kibetza, they're already going to bench. And therefore, therefore, that's why I favor them. That is the answer of the Gemara in Brachos. The Malachim asks, why do you favor the Jewish people? The answer is because they bench after a kazayas or after a kibetza. So the question, of course, is, well, how does Eli to be? It's very nice that they bench after a kazayas or a kibetza, but how does that translate into favoring of all the things that they could do? Reb Chaim of Elazhin is quoted as asking another question. Hashem says, I only told them to bench after they've had a full meal, but they're medaktikim al atzmam. So they're particular with themselves. That's a very, very specific use turn of phrase. Because we would translate it freely as, and they're more stringent already to bench after a kazayas or a kibetza, which we do. But why is that called medaktikim al atzma? It's also interesting to note that it doesn't say, hey, machmirim al atzma, they're more stringent. Again, that in our free translation, we would say they're machmir, to bench after a kazayas. The Gemara says, hey, medaktikim al atzma. I believe, perhaps, that we may suggest that the explanation here is based on a comment of the Meshech Chochma in Parshas Ekev. And there he talks about the mitzvah of benching. What's benching all about? We would be inclined to say on a simple level that benching is it's saying thank you. It's Hakaras HaTov, which is a good Jewish value. But Meshech Chochma says there's more to benching than that. Benching is not just about saying thank you. Benching is a way of ensuring that we are not led down a dangerous path as a result of the meal. There is a tendency, and the pasuk talks about it, when a person eats and is satisfied, there's a certain feeling that comes in where he's on top of the world and he's in charge of his destiny and he's in charge of all of his successes. None of his failures, obviously, but that's what the pasuk says. It talks about it openly. Actually, there in Parshas Ekev, Pentocha v'Savata, you'll eat, you'll be satisfied. V'ram levavecha, your heart will be raised. V'shachachtas Hashem Elokecha. It's a certain state to the person, right? When life is good, and therefore that's why the Torah says the time to bench is afterwards, which is actually very interesting, because normally when one receives a favor, you don't wait until you've consumed it to say thank you. If it's about thank you, Hakaras HaTov, so then why would the Torah only demand that you bench after eating and not before? Should one waits to say thank you? So saying thank you is a Derech Eretz thing, which the Rabbanon translated into making brachas beforehand. But the Torah's goal, so to speak, with benching afterwards, it's not about saying thank you. It's in order to address the issue of v'ram levavecha, the way a person feels after they've had a full meal, they feel they can do anything and they don't need anyone's help. V'ram levavecha v'shachachtas Hashem Elokecha. That's what benching is all about. In light of those words, I wonder if we may suggest that this is really the beauty of what's behind the stringency or the of Bnei Yisrael. They bench even after a kazayas, even after a kibetza. If the theme, if the concern is, if you eat too much, you may forget Hashem. So Bnei Yisrael are medaktikim al atzmam. They're particular with themselves. They're not particularly with their food, how would we otherwise describe it? They're machmir with regards to the amount that they eat. They're medaktikim al atzmam, as if to say they're watching themselves so carefully that even a minimal amount, they don't wish to already fall prey to what the pasuk is describing. You ate and you feel good and you forget about Hashem. The medaktikim, the al-atzman, they're saying, we don't want to only leave it till we've had a full meal to take measures to ensure that we don't forget about Hashem. Even if we only had a kazayas or kibetza, we're already watching ourselves that we stay mindful of Hashem in the world. That's why it's called medaktikim al-atman. It's about a self-assessment, that translates into benching after a kazayis and a kibetza. That explains the expression medaktikim, and also explains the expression al atzma. And we may therefore appreciate why there is a certain now midah keneged midah. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying to show the Bnei Yisrael special consideration, to shine his face on them and to be good to them and to remain close with them, and closeness of the proximity of the Shekhinah is what leads to all blessing, because the Bnei Yisrael are taking extra measures to be sure that they don't distance themselves from me. They don't allow anything to come in between them and me. Kazayas and Kibetza were already benching, just to keep that connection open, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If they want to keep that connection open to that degree, from my part it's also open. That becomes Masopat. Now, at the end, or I say the end, it's really the second half of Parshas Noso, is the Korbanos of the Nesiim. It's 89 Psukim, because the Pasuk repeats them, each one in full. And the beginning of the Perek Zion, before we get to the psukim that we know very well from Chanukah, Korbanot, Karas Kesef, Achas, etc., there are general korbanos that are brought. And that's in the beginning of Perek Zion. There are wagons. Pasuk Gimel vayaviu es korbanam lefnei Hashem sheshek lo tzad. There were six wagons, shnei asar bakar and 12 oxen. Moshe takes those and he apportions them. Some of the wagons he gives to, as the pasuk says, in Vav and Zion and Ches, he gives some to Gershon, some to Merari. They'll need them to take the parts of the Mishka. But pasuk tes vilevnei kahas lo nasa. But to Kahas, he didn't give any wagons. Why? Because they don't need them. Everything that they're in charge of, they carry personally. Ki avodas ha-kodesh aleihem. Their work is holier, b'nei Kahas. Bakos seif yiso. They carry on the shoulder. They don't care. They don't carry with wagons. Okay, as we know, the kelim of the Mishkan are carried personally, the beams of the Mishkan and the curtains and the other pertinences of the Mishkan, they are for the wagons, that's for the domain of Kahas and Merari. There is a fascinating reverberation of this pasuk, which is discussed in the Gemara in Maseches Sota in Daf Lamed Hei. There, it talks about the episode of Peretz Uzzah. Peretz Uzzah was when they're bringing the Aron back from captivity from the Plishtim, and they're bringing it back to upwards towards Yerushalayim, and it's the Haftarah for Parsha Shmini. And somehow the Aron, it falls out of balance with the wagon that it's on, and Uzzah, who's one of the people there, he holds out his hand in order to steady it, and he's struck down dead on the spot. He touched the Aron, and it was a terrible disappointment after the whole build-up and all the anticipation and the excitement and celebration, and then everything just kind of came crashing down. And they called the place Peretz Uzzah. Adayom Azeh, says the pasuk. Now, an aspect of the background, as far as we're concerned, the only one who's indicted here is Uzzah. I mean, he shouldn't have reached out to steady the Aron, even though, from his point of view, it looked like it was going to fall. Even so, he can't touch the Aron. So it's really the only protagonist here is Uzzah. But the Gemara gives further background. The Gemara says that there was an aspect of punishment here for David HaMelech. What did David HaMelech do wrong? Well, the pasuk in Tehillim reads, Tehillim Kuf Yotes, Zemiros Hayoli Chukecha, the Beis Megurai. David characterizes Chukim, Divrei Torah, as Zemiros, as music. And that was considered incorrect. Hashem says to David, you call Divrei Torah Zemiros? Divrei Torah have to be guarded very carefully. And you call them Zemiros? Part of the punishment of David HaMelech for calling Divrei Torah Zemiros was, says Hashem, I will cause you to make a mistake to a degree regarding something that even a child knows. Namely, it was David's decision to put the Aron on a wagon in the first place. Had it been carried personally by Kohanim, none of this would have happened. And the Pasuk says, Ki avodas hakodesh aleihem, because if you saw the Aron should not be put on a wagon, it should be carried personally. And David forgot that, or he made a mistake about it. Hashem says a child knows that, a cheder child knows that. So if you call divrei Torah as mirrors, that's what will happen. You make mistakes like that. What's the measure of the mistake? As Mefarshim explained, it's possible to understand that the insistence that it's that it be carried by person, on people's shoulders, maybe that's only true for the Mishkan, at the time of the Mishkan, where so many unique halachas applied. But maybe Lederos, maybe it's not necessary. That's not true, but there's grounds to make a mistake like that. But, of course, the Gemara is quite enigmatic. How are these two things connected? David HaMelech calls Divrei Torah as Miros, and he makes a mistake about putting the Torah on a wagon. I mean, is there anything about that, the particular nature of the mistake? Secondly, what's wrong with calling Divrei Torah as Miros? It doesn't sound that bad. It's nice. It sounds nice. And it's also very interesting that when all said and done, the Pasuk remains in Tehillim. Guf Yotes, it's in the Zions. Any good Jew who reads Tehillim reads that Pasuk, Zmiris Alikirchacha. If it's such an objectionable thing, it should have been deleted from Sefer Tehillim, not left for generations of Jews subsequently to make the same incorrect statement about Torah. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that actually, although we say it's wrong to call Torah Zmiros, the Torah calls itself Shira. As far as we're concerned, Shira and Zimra are largely the same thing. What's the difference between them? So Shlomo Zalman, in a very fine but deep distinction, explains the difference between them is that Zmiros has a somewhat more superficial connotation. It's a tune, as opposed to Shira, which is a song. The difference between them is that a song is a deep emotional connection. It's impactful on the person, whereas Zmiros have a somewhat more lightweight and perhaps entertaining ring to them, without a more of a profound connection. The difference between a song and a tune. Now, it's possible that David HaMelech only had further embellishments in mind when he called the Divrei Torah Zmiros, and maybe that's room for that. But to give room to understand that that's all there is to Torah, Zmiros, they're entertaining, and they've got a nice ring to them. So that was the indictment of David HaMelech. Divrei Torah are a Shira, but they're not Zmiros. They're a song, but they need investment. They need to reach the person. Perhaps we may understand that how this translated into a mistake of putting the Aron onto the wagon. Things that are dear and near to a person, he doesn't give to others to carry or to put into a wagon. Person, you carry a Sefer Torah. You don't put it in the car and then you'll meet it at the other side. Person carries their passport with them. They carry their tefillin with them. And therefore, in a sense, it was a bit of an emanation of calling Divrei Torah as Miros. If what's contained in the Torah doesn't have that life-giving impact for the person, so he maybe is just as inclined to put it on a wagon and let the oxen bring it to Jerusalem as it is to have people carry it themselves. So these, of course, these are on the very elevated levels of David HaMelech, but the lesson for us is extremely important. We learn Torah and we say Vaharev. Now we want the Divrei Torah to be enjoyable, but it's not there for entertainment. It's enjoyable because when we enjoy it, it permeates our essence. But the goal of Divrei Torah is not to be there as Miras. It's to be there as a Shira. It's not to be there as a tune to delight us. is there to be as a song to inspire us and to impact us and to guide us and instruct us, to accompany us through all of life's situations. And this, therefore, is a very interesting message that comes out even before the repetitions get going. That's the mission statement of Torah. And food for thought, we'll leave it over there.